Okay, welcome back to Zohar. We're in the middle of the Omer, so it's always exciting to be doing this now. And I guess today, maybe the title of today's class in honor of Peter is How to Make the Universe Fly. Is that right?
Yeah.
That was a really
beautiful
quote. I don't know if we should read it into the record.
Well, and unusual in that physicists today don't tend to speak at all, or let alone with such eloquence, on topics that would nowadays be considered flaky. So this Wheeler is one of the last of a great generation who one could quote on that.
Is there more you want to say about that?
No, only that it seemed interesting that he'd been anticipated by many centuries in a completely different genre of writing. That's all. It struck me.
So what I wanted to do is discuss the following, which was a parallel passage to our passage. You know, we had the something Rabbi Confort did reminded me. Last time in the Zohar, we were talking, we're on page, what now, 15b?
Right. 116, 117 in the English.
Yeah, and we were discussing this idea, you know, before the Blessed Elohim created the world, he and his name were enclosed within him, one, and how God struggled to create the world. And in the Midrashic version of it, it's until Teshuvah is created. The version Rabbi Confort quoted, is that right? Teshuvah is the thing that enables the universe to withstand like an entropy force of sorts. And in the Zoharic version, at least, here it's God's enwrapping himself in a wrapping of radiance, supernal right, right? That's the, so it's God's immanence, which is a different or maybe related play off of that. So that reminded me of something that Yehuda Libes said a lot. People may know Yehuda Libes as one of the great scholars of Zohar. In Israel, and he noted that they made a choice. I'm giving a meta-reflection on the Zohar, because so he noted a few things that he's known for. One of them is the omnipotence of Shimon Bar Yochai in the Zohar, which is that even when he's not present on the pages, everything there's at any moment he could come and know what they've said, and they're always saying things in relation to him, and sometimes they just go into praise of him, and then he disappears for pages and pages at a time, but he's never, like, not there, even if he's not there. So that's one of the things he noted as a distinct feature of Zoharic literature, and I think we've seen that already all of a sudden a few times. Shimon Bar Yochai is there and crowning them over the teachings they've given, even though he wasn't there when they taught the teachings, right? He's omnipotent in this way, or omnipresent, kind of. But also omnipotent in the Zohar. He's the hero of the Zohar, is what he called him. And the other thing he noted is that the Zohar chose to do midrash, right? In other words, it's arranged and it's in the genre of midrash. If you had to give it a genre, it's a mystical midrash, what he called a midrash mystiki, right? It's a mystical midrash. It's arranged according to the order of the parshiot in the way that a midrash is, and they're learning verses. Which is not the way that other Kabbalah is arranged. It's much more philosophical. And it may be that that is in response to Maimonides a little bit. And in a kind of response to the idea. I don't know why. Why did the Zohar choose to do Midrash in Castile as opposed to, you know, and the people in the Zoharic school wrote philosophical Kabbalistic works that aren't nearly as grand or wonderful as the Zohar. But I imagine a lot of it must have been a response to Maimonidean and philosophical thinking in general, and saying that religion is more than philosophy, right? It is mythology, it is eros, it is relationship, it is passion, it is devotion, it is take your list that appear here in the Zohar. And so it is mystery, and it is Hebraya, it's community. So Midrash is a good choice if you're trying to do something other, because it's a classic way, just in the same way that they put their teachings in the mouth of figures from antiquity. Say we're doing something older, even though they're doing something totally new. So, okay, those are my prefatory comments. So Rabbi Confer just reminded me of the fact that the Zohar as Midrash, and then also because it chooses to do Midrash, then when it's interpreting particular verses or concepts, it must make allusion to, respond, or be in dialogue with the way the actual Midrashic literature dealt with those things, because it's doing Midrash, which is a kind of a choice it made. But whatever it made that choice, once it did that, they obviously knew the Midrashic literature. They're very fond of it. And so it makes sense that they're playing with it. Now, I wanted to discuss another version of pre-creation at another point in the Zohar as a comparative. And so there are basically two passages I want to read. This would be in volume 3 of the mat. You may not have volume 3 with you, but I'll read it if that's okay. So the first passage, and this is in the Idra Rabbah. So the Idra Rabbah is considered like the mystical height of Zoharic writing. There's the Idra Zuta, the small chamber, and the Idra Rabbah, the large chamber. And those are considered two parts of the Zohar where there's special urgency. You should know that in the Idras, the basic narrative point there is that Rabbi Shimon assembles the assembly. By the way, people die during this convocation. It's a gathering. And there are deaths that happen as a result of fire consuming people, for like Nadav and Avihu style, for the wrong or right teachings or in kind of mystical mystery. And so it's a very, like, the moment is heightened, and it already alludes at the beginning. You know, he says, like, one of us will die today, in a, like, Jesus, Judas kind of moment. You know, like, someone's going to betray me. Someone will die. And so Rabbi Shimon knows what's going to happen. But that already puts the, you know, someone's going to die, raises the stakes quite a lot of whatever is going on. And he opens by saying, it's time to act for God, tear up the Torah, is the way he understands it. It's one of the early uses of this. I know that politically, it's one of the things that Haredim in Israel have used to justify, not working, which was the traditional way, is, well, after the Holocaust, we all have to study because so many Torah scholars were killed. And they quote the verse in the rabbinic literature justifying non-work, Eit la'asot la'ashem, time to act for God, heferu Torah tekel, the Torah has been torn up. Descriptively, it doesn't mean that. It just means, because the Torah is torn, we must act for God. But the creative reuse of it says that in a time of emergency measures, you can suspend habeas corpus if you're Abraham Lincoln or whatever the right metaphor is. So Rabbi Shimon uses it to say that, now what's the dramatic emergency for Rabbi Shimon? That is something scholars love to talk about. It's unstated. There's a dramatic emergency that causes them to have to do something great or the world won't last. but they don't tell you what the problem is. Just mm-hmm. the world is about to be destroyed, which is the same, I will note, as the problem we're dealing with of the world coming into existence in the first. It's just kicked down the road, right? you know, even now, at any moment, the world stands in the balance, which is a play on the regular rabbinic idea that at any moment, good and evil stand in balance. And without kind of, Maimonides has a version of this, right? Without, you know, more good than bad, the world wouldn't be. So the first thing he says is he notes a problem of biblical criticism. I'm going to say two things today. One is about this biblical criticism problem in the Kings of Edom, and the second is about the curtain and pre-creation, and then we'll get back to our text. What's the biblical criticism problem? Genesis 36:31 says that these are the kings who reigned in the land of Edom. Elam lachim asher malchu be'eretz Edom, I think it is, right? Lifnei meloch melech, al b'nei Yisrael, is that the, or something like that, before there was a king over Israel. So the biblical critical problem is, what do you mean before there was a king over Israel? The Torah is being written, before there was a king in Israel implies we're writing the Torah after we know there's a king in Israel, which only happened after the Torah. So wait, who's writing this Torah? That's why I call it the biblical criticism problem.
Mm-hmm.
So Rabbi Shimon raises this issue in just those terms. What do you mean? Doesn't the Torah? He raises the biblical critical question, which is amazing to think these Castilian mystical rabbis are, wait, this verse makes no sense. It sounds as if the Torah is written the wrong way. So he says, you know, who can make sense of this verse and not interpret it in a heretical way? Right? Who can do it? So what does it mean? So Rabbi Shimon, then, after no one can do it, Rabbi Shimon gives an answer. These are the kings who reigned. So first he quotes the whole thing. These are the kings who reigned. Bela, the son of Beor, reigned in Edom. The name of his city was Dinhaba. Bela died. And he quotes the whole Edomite king list. And then he says the following thing. The kings of Edom died.
Oh, Rabbi, before you go on, I just got an email from Joe Souza, says he's in the waiting room.
Oh. Thank you. I'm sorry. Sorry, Joe. I got lost in Zohar.
Oh, all right. Good. Yeah, I wasn't sure it was.
No. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
We're describing the Edomite kings in the Idra Rabbah as an alternative account of pre-creation. We did an account of pre-creation last time, and I gave way too many words to introduce another account in the Zohar that I want to compare.
Okay. I'll just try to catch up.
So Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says, the kings of Edom died. Why did the Edomite kings before there was a king in Israel die? They died because of their singleness. They had no balance, no harmony of male and female. They symbolized the primordial worlds of void that were destroyed before the stable and enduring world was able to be created. In parallel, these kings play a poetic role. Kings are thoughts that arise in the mind of creator who came to regret them. So he understands that before there was a king in Israel doesn't mean a biblical problem. It means that these were the worlds that God tried to create before God created the world that God did create, the midrashic worlds that were created and destroyed.
Mm.
And then it has been taught. Before the Ancient of Ancients, concealed of concealed, prepared adornments of the king and crowns of crowns, there was neither beginning nor end. He engraved, engaged within himself, and spread before himself. So this is a key point. If you haven't paid attention until now, now we get to a pre-creation account with these kings. So God is creating these, we preface, these Edomite kings before there was a king in Israel are the worlds God tried to create. He drafted the rules of the physics on paper, but they didn't fly, right? That's our metaphor. Those are the Edomite kings, which is an interesting use of Edomite kings as worlds God. He engraved and gauged within himself and spread. So God engraved and gauged. I'll repeat it because you don't have the text. We're on volume 3, 128a. Engaged, engraved, engaged kings, the kings of Edom, but his adornments did not endure. As is written, these are the kings who reigned in the land of Edom before a king reigned, the primordial king over the children in Israel, the primordial one. All those who had been engraved were called by name, but they could not endure. So he put them aside and concealed them. Afterward, he ascended in that curtain and was arrayed perfectly. So, here we have a different metaphor. God has a curtain. Let's just, and where is this curtain? Is it outside of God's self or inside of God's self?
Is it the wrapping?
Yeah.
In the first one from Psalms 104.
Right. So is it the same metaphor as we're working with, but a little bit different? And he tries to array the Edomite kings in the curtain. But they don't work because of a lack of balance of male and female. That's a stated reason. So the world was imbalanced, meaning what? There was too much kindness, probably too much judgment. They're Edomite kings from Red Adom, you know? In other words, and of course there's too much judgment because if God tries to create outside of God's self, that's an act of total discernment and separation, right? And so you need that in order to get out of God's self. It's a meta thing. It's not just God happened to create a world with too much judgment. The act of challenge of creating a world if you're God is automatically capped up in all kinds of judgment or din in the biblical sense of creating boundaries and separation. Except that you can't create a world of boundaries and separation that sustains itself. There's no balance. It's not in relationship. It's a kind of proto-Lorianic idea. So eventually, God puts himself in the king. Now,
God puts himself
in the curtain.
Okay.
Now, I'll read a little more about that. I'll keep reading just a little bit more. And it has been taught. An impulse arose in the will. And I think we had will, ratzon, in our teaching.
Right, yeah. Within the will of thought.
And here we have an impulse arose in the will, the ratzon. So again, where have we been taught this? We've been taught this in our Zohar. And the Zohar is now referencing itself earlier. As Matt notes, he quotes our page on this page. It's been taught, you know, just in the footnote citation. So that's fun. It would be good to cross-reference all of these in some way.
Yeah.
It has been taught. An impulse arose in the will to create. The Torah had been concealed for 2,000 years, and he brought her out. Immediately, she said before him, he who wishes to arrange and form the world should first arrange his own array. So here, there was an impulse in the ratzon, in the will to create, and the Torah, who had been hiding, just like the Edomite kings who were put away in hiding, comes out and says, well, God, if you would like to create a world, you first need to create yourself, his own array. So here we have this weird thing. Before God creates the world, the Torah engages in a, like, it's almost like God's advisor in the creation of the world.
Well, that's not quite unlike Bereshit, with Reshit, which is Torah. He created the world, so you could say it's kind of parallel to this, because the punchline at the end of that paragraph on the top of 117 is the mystery is this verse with Reishit Elohim created heavens and earth. And also the famous, you know, Torah is a blueprint. So God consults Torah in the Midrash, in the classic Midrash, to help him create the world. And like the other piece, they transform the classic Midrash into a mystical Midrash, as you were saying that Yehuda Libus suggests.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. They transform the classical Midrash into a mystical Midrash. Exactly. And then this ends. Afterward, he ascended in that curtain and was arrayed perfectly. Right, so.
Can I ask about the metaphor of the kings?
Yeah.
So we've got Edomite kings before there was a king of Israel. And then the Torah is telling God to create God's self. Is it maybe saying that are the Edomite kings like imperfect pre-versions of God that didn't work?
So definitely the classic mystics take these hidden kings as these demon lords, which still lurk. They're like sources of evil. Almost, I actually think these passages in the Zohar are nearly Gnostic, because they have these evil hidden kings, which are demigods, which root back to before God's creation, even of God's self. and so they're like this early root of evil in the Godhead, you know? But yeah, I think that's right. They're kind of like pre-gods.
And so, but while we're on the subject, right?
Which is a way of reading the verse literally also, right? Because the early religions were proto-religions from the Zohar's perspective.
Right. But now, when Torah is telling God to create God's self, which sphera is Torah talking to?
In right, self, did the sphera not exist yet?
Presumably, like Keter and so forth, you know, at the very, very top, right? Because then the rest of it is, in effect, God creating God's self. Or is this being too literal-minded about something that's supposed to be?
No. Say a little more.
I thought we were supposed to, at least one way of looking at this panoply of ten sphirot is that they are a form of emanation that bears some kind of resemblance to the process of creation. And if the creation of God's self is in question, and if we're talking about God finding the right form, then we should be thinking about putting that creation thing in the context of why we have 10 spherot.
Yes. Anyone else want to respond to that?
If we're talking primordial, though, I don't know why I got this, but I thought the spherot were part of creation. Like, I thought the initial, it was sort of some, it was an interaction between Malchut and maybe Keter, or maybe like some, whatever's above Keter, that thing, the spherot get created in kind of an electrical circuit or something like that. That was a metaphor in my head.
By the way, I see now Matt in footnote 67 here quotes this passage. He cross quotes it in both places, Zohar 3:128a. Mm-hmm. I just read the passage on 3:128a to you.
Mm-hmm.
So that is this. I guess we got in the footnote. I think that Keter, will, usually means Keter, Ratzon. So I think by because they put will in, or the will of thought, which is keter as it already relates to chokhmah, we're talking about keter.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting what Peter asked. So I looked at the, you know, the names associated with different sfirot, but no sfira is connected with Torah itself. Is that correct?
Well, I thought Malchut was connected with Torah.
You know, Shechina is loosely connected with Torah. I mean, here Torah is a she. She's feminine when she speaks. And God is a he. We already have that. And we already have them having noted in the passage in the Idra that the problem with the Edomite kings was the lack of balance between not right and left, but male and female. So we have this theory here of like, well, if you want to create, but you can't create, you might look at whether you've got the right genders. and so the Torah might be a primordial female, but not a specific Torah.
Somewhere in my huge number of pencil marks on the diagram of the Sefirot, I wrote in next to Malchut, oral law, and next
to Tiferet, written law.
Yes,
which is true, and I think here it's a Torah Keduma. It's an early proto Torah. It's neither, and God hasn't even figured out how to be God yet. So certainly there aren't Taryag Mitzvot. We're before that. So what are we? So I think this is this idea of, you know, it's like, well, the Torah we have is just one possible manifestation of a much truer Torah in the mystical sense of it, or a much, you know, of a Torah that goes deeper back. And here it's as if once God has a will to create, there's always a Torah. In other words, whenever God is relating to God's self and the possibility of anything other, there's a Torah that's there. It, almost that thought causes the Torah to exist first.
Is Keter considered masculine in this system?
Keter is considered masculine in this system.
Yeah.
Ish.
Okay.
Ish.
So I was going to ask, since we're mystically reading the first verse as with beginning Elohim created the heavens and the earth, who's Elohim? And I'm finding a pencil mark next to Bina.
Bina, yeah.
Okay. So is this Keter in dialogue with Bina in particular, or?
Right. Well, who is this dialogue with? I do think there's some ambivalence here to it, right? Which is that, like, the Torah is really surprising here. And the Torah's advice is a little shocking to God. Before you create, get your own house in order. Like, what makes you think? It's almost as if God were a person. Like, God suddenly becomes like Ahasuerus or something, like a slightly foolish political leader in the way I read this, the tone I'm hearing it. And the Torah is like, who are you to create? You got to figure out yourself first. It's almost like, don't worry about other people. Worry about yourself first is the Torah's advice, which is sound advice if you imagine the Torah is representing like a wisdom tradition of sorts, you know, like, you know, those in glass houses shouldn't throw stones, the Torah says to God in a reverse affirmation. So, and then God arrays God's self in the curtain, right? I know where I'm avoiding or eliding the sphera question, but just imagine the image. God tries to create Edomite kings in this curtain. Now, what is this curtain? This is a really interesting. The curtain is different in the Idra than what we have here, right? What we don't have in ours, we have a lot of the same things. We have the will. We have worlds that are created and destroyed. They're given a little more texture in the Idra. They're the Edomite kings, and they are concealed as a source of evil to forever lurk and a proto-source of demons in the mystical chain. That's different than our passage, but that's just an expansion.
Well, I think Peter asked whether the curtain's parallel to the garment here. The wrapping.
What's the word that's translated as wrapping by Matt?
And what's the word for curtain? Is it the pargod, like achorei pargod?
It is pargod.
Mm-hmm. And wrap, that's the curtain in the Idra Rabba, but what's with the wrapping here in?
In a wrapping of radio.
Okay, someone's got to load this. Hold on.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Load the Zohar text.
This is.
I think the word is talit.
Maskinus, you ask from the Nikude. I think I'm here. Hold on, because Zohar Nikuna to Tana Rakia. Nikuna to go in the Mishpat and the Pshit of us. That's when Nikuna Kahat of the Matmanim. Suchlet Wapiland. Yeah, you know, and I don't know why this is, the Sfaria version just doesn't have this paragraph.
Right. It just jumps to another.
Oh, that's why I can't find it. Okay.
Right.
You know, I don't see a Girsa note in the mat.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, you know, if we imagine this curtain, which maybe God is wrapped in maybe it is the garment God is wrapped in here, since they've sought to Tanan, right, as we have learned. But here it's really just being described as a curtain, and it's God is looking at the curtain, right?
Mm-hmm.
God is not wearing the garment yet, and God puts God's self in the curtain. So it is a projection of God that God creates. So the first thing God needs to do is project God's self onto a two-dimensional space that is fewer dimensions than the space God exists in already. Right, that's an act of limitation to create a projection and array it, whatever that means, you know, like to give it ornaments and kind of decorations. So the advice of the Torah is something like God has to decide who God will want to be. and God chooses to, but the important thing is that God has to move first, right? If God can't create, God has to, now God can't change, right? Do you see the difficult place we're in the Idra? We're in this place, but God never changes. Everything is God, nothing is God. God projects God's self into a curtain that God looks at. So I don't, we'll move on in a minute, but does anyone want to reflect on that answer in and of itself? And then also in a comparative sense, how that is or isn't different than God in wrapping God's self in a garment of light. They're very similar answers, but they are different answers. This is why I wanted to do this whole thing. Which is, there they get to the same place and they say God had to, the Torah had to advise God to project God's self into the curtain first. I hope you see why I felt like we couldn't not read this passage with this passage.
I'm not sure this is exactly speaking to the question that you just raised, but is it possible that this dialogue between God and the Torah is like the question of the laws of nature on the floor, but they don't fly? So Torah is like the laws or all the possible versions of the laws that could be instantiated, or the set of all possible things. But God's self is the, as you said last time, that God has to be the being, the existence part, the flying part of the laws. So it's another version in this interpretation. That dialogue is another version of the dialectic between principles and existence itself.
Yes. And they're not answering it plainly, right?
Right.
Now, in the Idra, and this is important, they're then going to go on to describe three faces of God in the curtain that God drew, and how they've been, how the garment, how the curtain has been damaged, and how they need to repair God's original images of God's self that God drew in the curtain. And they're going to describe it in granular detail, down to the hair or wart, or like they're going to really get into the details God projected in this curtain of God's self. Like God drew an image, images of God. Wow. And they're these haunting faces that they construct, because they're not, they're kind of quasi-human, but if you draw them, they're haunting faces. You know, they're weird. Face, like they describe faces. We'll get there probably in about 2 years.
My sense is here there's no pre-creation, whereas in the Idra it seems that God has to do something on the advice of the Torah before God can arrive at the point where we are here. Because here it seems God's totally in control. If you lift this passage out, you don't get that God had to do something to God's self before God had, well, except for wrapping in light and then create, but God didn't have to internally in this passage that we were dealing with do a prequel to thinking about wrapping and creating.
But God doesn't struggle here, right? There's no like, God can't do it. I mean, they raise the problem, but they don't have God trying and failing and trying and failing and trying and failing.
It traced and built, but it did not endure.
So maybe they do?
Well, it's you can read it as it's outside of God that he was making failed creations, which maybe isn't the same as getting God's nature straight.
Right, straight. Yeah.
Right. It's like, it's almost milder here.
Yeah.
It's almost like the Idra just takes this and like exaggerates it a little more in a certain way. At both parts, the failure is exaggerated in more detail. And the consequence isn't just that it doesn't endure, but that it's concealed. Right here, it doesn't endure. There, it's concealed and becomes a source of evil. So there, it's like there are consequences. Here, there are no consequences to this non-endurance. And then the second thing is here, just God wraps God's up, whereas there, God needs to be advised by something external to God before there is anything external to God, as we've mentioned, about God's own need to work on God's self first. Like God's priorities are wrong. So there's a harsher rebuke to it. Mm-hmm. And then what God needs to do, project God's self, feels like a stronger move than just wrap God's self.
Mm-hmm.
Even though wrapping and clothing is a way of projecting or presenting to another, that's one image. But it's one thing to say that you make statements about who you are through your fashion choices, which is essentially what this is. That's the metaphor here. Whereas there, the metaphor is God needed to draw God's self. Like, in other words, the total self-creation of God. And then the question is, what are they saying about us? Right. In other words, whenever we're talking about God's existence, not far behind is the nihilistic question of what does, if anything, does our own existence mean? And to what extent are we masters of our own self-creation versus just plays? You know, God needs to totally invent God's self or reinvent God's self, according to the Torah, you know, and which is a form of teshuvah. Right? God needs to do teshuvah. It's almost like they're taking the Midrash more seriously than the Torah. So you need to do teshuvah first before you can create, you know?
Can I ask, who's the mashkilim in this then?
The mashkilim are the mystics.
So that's supposed to be like what we're trying to be. Are we trying to be mashkilim?
We're trying to be mashkilim. That's right.
So we're supposed to be the pillars and the sockets and the... Yeah.
So I hope it's been useful. Okay, we'll keep going on.
Could you just say a word about, I know nothing about the Idra. Is this the same group or Moshe de Leon?
Yeah. The Idra
is it another work that's in dialogue with what we're calling the Zohar?
There are three other works, Sefer Tzniuta, the Book of Concealment, the Idra Rab, and the Idra Zuta. The Zohar was published like Migilot, scroll at a time. And they appeared over the course of, that's a debate. We don't know if they came out over 10 years or 50 years. Academics debate how long did the scrolls come out. Basically, every couple of weeks, a new book would just emerge and be circulated. They were always in Castile, but they very quickly made their way to Israel. And we know about this. How do we know about this? Because there was a rabbi, Yitzchak of Akko. And Akko was, he was there. It was the last, crusader fort, and he's there just before it falls, I think. He hears about these books which are being written, and he starts to see manuscripts of them in Israel, and he can't believe what he's reading. He writes a letter to his rabbinic colleagues. Yitzchak is the chief rabbi of Akko. He's like one of the major rabbis in Israel, Yitzchak of Akko. And he writes a letter to the rabbis of the diaspora about these new Megillot scrolls called Sifrei Zohar, Books of Radiance. And he can't believe what he's reading. He said, there's nothing like this. I've never seen anything like these books. They're wild, basically. He even writes, you'd think they're on drugs in his letter. you'd think they're using, I think he says, herbal supplements to have, visions. But like, he basically says, like, are they using LSD? What is this? And then he says, so he decided to take a voyage to Castile to go figure out, because he said, everyone, they always appear first in Castile. So I'm going to Castile to investigate for all of Israel. What's the story? Are they legitimate? What are these things? And so he writes a long letter about his documenting his trip and voyage and conversations in Castile. And the height of his letter is that I don't know if maybe we should have read the letter before we started studying the Zohar, but he, he meets with Moshe De Leon at like a local like tea shop. And he says, what's the story? Moshe De Leon takes an oath and swears and uses the name of God in his oath and says, I swear I have a manuscript from Shimon Bar Yochai in my library at home. So he makes an appointment to go see it. But that morning he learns that Moshe De Leon died. and like, that's basically where it all comes to an end, kind of. And it's almost too good suddenly and unexpectedly. It's almost like too good to, the story is crazy, you know? So he meets with the wife and the wife says, no, we were poor. He needed money. He forged it. But then he meets with another rabbi who says that like their marriage was on the rocks. And like the wife would say anything to trash him, and you shouldn't listen to the wife. And like when you read the letter, you see it gets like kind of what this is. That's all in the letter. But so like the question becomes: do you believe Moshe De Leon? Do you believe his wife? Ultimately, Yitzchak of Akko concludes that Moshe De Leon channeled like the spirit of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai through use of Kabbalistic magic and was writing as a medium, because Moshe De Leon, he writes, I examined the works of Moshe De Leon and they're okay, but they're nowhere near the level of sophistication of the Zohar. And so I don't think the guy I met could have wrote this. I met him and I don't think he could have done this, you know? And I read his other works and they're okay, but they're not this. That's what we know is this letter. And the question is, how much should we believe the letter of Yitzchak of Akko? But he doesn't seem to have any incentive to, and he reports everything very candidly, you know, that he hears on his investigation. Okay, so all that is to say, Rabbi Confer, these three, the Idra Rabbah, the Idra Zut, and the Sefer Tzniuta, all appeared as whole publications and were quickly published in the collection of books of the Zohar, and they're in Zoharic style, and they are whatever. So it's clear that the same people were involved in them, but it's, those three works all are published as whole units and far more advanced. Like in the way I just showed you, like the thinking clearly shows advancement beyond the earlier. So scholars think that it's like later refined writings of the same circle. That makes sense.
All right. That would explain this morning's difference a little bit.
Right. It's like, what if the same people complex, 30 years later?
Right. Well, it makes the moment of creation much more complex by adding a God level. God had to do something before God just wrapped himself in light and created.
Right. God needed to figure out how God could be still God, worthy of the title God. But also, since beings, mortal beings, could never understand an infinite God or relate in any way, God needed a projection. And here they're getting at something very deep, which is that all of religion ultimately serves as a projection of a deity, right? In other words, we all project authority onto, they're saying something which could be seen as highly heretical, which is like everyone has a need to project authority in ways that cast images so that they can believe there is authority. And even God needed to be able to create a projection, you know, a bearded deity that people could. This could be a response to Maimonides also. People need images and a face and, you know, people need that. And in fact, if people didn't need that, God could not have created. There wouldn't be a universe if there was just an unmoved mover. Because there's no reason for that. So, I don't know. Yeah. Should we try and do a little more on where we were? I realize I've thrown, you know, the Idra is always... And the Idra Zutta is like a little bit, and the Idra Rabba is a lot. The Zutta came out first, so it's pretty clear, like build and then more build. By the way, the one custom which came from the Idra Rabba, while we're here, you should know about, is Tashlich, which is why maybe next year we'll do a mini unit before Tashlich if we're okay veering every so often. Once you like open the Idra, it's hard to close the can. So the Idra Rabba has this idea that there's 13 lower attributes of mercy. You know, Hashem, Hashem, El Rachum, V'chanun, Erech, Alpaim, Rav, Chesed, V'emet, that correspond more or less to, you know, like Tiferet or something like that. Mm-hmm. The written Torah, as it were, Moshe, that level. But there's a Keter level, a higher level of 13 higher attributes that correspond to the verse in Micha. And actually understanding those 13 attributes, which it views as the ones that empower the lower attributes of mercy, is the way to achieve real repentance. And that forms the basis for the liturgy that develops surrounding Tashlich using Micha. It's the Kabbalists that do that based on their read of the Idra. So Tashlich is like a ritual that is specifically derived from the very opening of the Idra. The way we do it. Jews always used to go to what was the old Tashlich? I read a few academic articles. Jews used to go and pray by the water. They always did that, but it wasn't a specific liturgy. Jews went to the water to pray for forgiveness. Mm-hmm. Then this liturgy developed with the Kabbalists of Sfat because they were reading the Zohar. I don't know if people say that liturgy, but it's in my Machzor.
We don't use it at the shores of the Seacock, do we?
We don't. I always go and say it privately.
Yeah, they used to have a little booklet that included the Micha passage, right? Mi'el Kamocha.
No Se'avon V'arver.
Yes. So those are the 13. You can divide that verse up into 13.
So this, just so you know, what the Idra does, each of those 13 represents a specific facial feature of God in coded language, and they're each damaged in some way on the image projection on the curtain, and they need to be repaired by an artisan. So the Idra consists of each of the 13 taking turns volunteering to repair different sections, but they need to do so not by actually doing art, but by creating new mystical interpretations of verses related to repentance. Which again takes us into, you know, the earliest midrash of all of this is repentance, right? Repentance needed to be created. So in the Idra's version of it, repentance needed to be repaired, which is like its own, you know. Okay. The enlightened will shine like the Zohar radiance of the sky. I think we might have read this, but it's okay. I'll read it anyway. These are pillars and sockets of that pavilion. Is this where we were?
Yeah.
Yes.
Right. And here we're taking language from the Mishkan very explicitly, but also the Shekhinah or the Chuppah or any other pavilion, the Sukkah. Hamazkilim, the enlightened, supernal pillars and sockets, contemplating in wisdom everything needed by that pavilion and its supports. Right. So this mystery accords with that what is said, happy is the Maskil, one who considers the poor. What is going on here? This is an idea that the Hasidim took very seriously. The Baal Shem Tov, it was one of his early pieces of advice. You should always do everything for the sake of the Shekhinah. People may know that advice of the Baal Shem Tov or not. In Tzavat HaRivash, early accounts of the Baal Shem Tov, the founder of Hasidism, his advice was that everything should be done for the sake of the Shekhinah because it's suffering. So we have this idea of the divine presence as a woman, an exiled woman, suffering, kind of like a Tisha B'Av motif. So this is, I think, an early source for that, right? Which is the enlightened, the mystics, are pillars and sockets. What do pillars and sockets do? They hold it up and they support the thing. So God isn't really manifest in the world. We're still on that same theme, yeah? unless mystics create structures for God to appear. What are structures? Rituals, teachings, consciousness states. Mystics need to help people see God, in other words. If they don't do that, then God won't be here. And they understand an allusion to this, right? A maskil, the plain meaning is someone who understands is one who is able to consider the poor. That's almost like a socioeconomic understanding of a maskil, right? One who sees privilege, one who sees need, one who sees power and corruption. And they change the social justice understanding of it to a different one, which is who's poor? The Shekhinah is poor. Why is the Shekhinah poor? Always. Do you know why the Shekhinah is poor?
She's like the moon.
She's what?
She's like the moon.
She's like the moon. Good. And what? Why? How is she like the moon?
Well, she's the receptor of the light, not the...
She reflects, but she has none of her own. She's reliant on charity of the moon. She's reliant on flow or bracha from God's above. So Shekhinah is a projection of God. But the projection of God that we most relate to or associate with in an active way, the immanent God, is actually, you know, just kind of like a puppet or a shell or a projection, you know, a projection of projection of projections. Imagine God is puppet master. And so there's this little puppet, but there's God behind it. Our God is a puppet, you know, with very little. Our God is simple. But then what do the mystics do? The mystics need to build that God up and make that God real for people. You know, they need to create the structures that allow all of the blessing to emanate and flow freely in, or so that some of God is seen in the Shekhinah. Right, they need to create the structures. So Now, importantly, God shines, and I'll just end on this note. How does God, in this passage, what does God do? God wraps God's self in a garment of radiance. I'm going to find the Hebrew for next time. That's my homework, and actually see what it says, the Aramaic. I'll find it somewhere. I have one version of the Zohar with me today, but it also has nothing. It just has what the mat has, so what the Sepharia has. So I don't know where this passage is and why it's not. I need to find out what the deal is with this passage. But
it's like the best passage ever.
I know, and it's not even in the versions of the Zohar. Like Matt,
I just got this. Someone just sent me this one. This is what I've been kind of looking at.
Yeah, I have that at home. Is it in there?
I think this is. I mean, this is like my Aramaic is kind of non-existent, but I think it's. Maybe you can read it, but I think it's like that page right there.
Okay, I'm going to go home and I'll get it for us, and I'll maybe copy it in.
Yeah.
So the one thing I want to close on is this idea: God creates God's self by being wrapped in a garment of radiance. God is a form of light energy, in this universe, and God is in it. And so here, who are the mystics? Well, they shine like the radiance of the sky. Right, the radiance of the sky is reflective of God's light. And so there's essentially with the mystics shine with the light of God, and that shining allows them to be conduits for this energy too, right? So the mystics here are like rebbes. They're guides to the divine light. They're conduits of it. Mm-hmm. And then it says, we'll shine. For unless they shine and radiate, they cannot contemplate that pavilion looking out for all its needs.
Mm.
Right? Unless they're doing that, then, and notice how they're looking out for the Shekhinah's needs. The Shekhinah has needs. And what does it need? It needs to be manifest. It needs bracha from above and below. It needs to be united above and below with us and with its energy and sources. So this gives us a very important theurgic role.
Mm.
God needs us, which is an idea, that I heard even in Hebrew school, as a kind of Jewish idea. I think it's just like a popularized idea. God, ein melech b'lo'am, they taught us there's no king without a nation. So here's some version of that. There's no light without mystics. There's no There's no God without constructs.
That's where Heschel got God in Search of Man.
Right.
He grew up in this culture.
Mm-hmm. God, Heschel, God in Search of Man.
Was it Berovam Hadras HaMelech?
But Heschel would say, right, there was no God without ethical shining, right? His whole thing was to understand that God is manifest in, I think, a kind of ethical mysticism of a certain sort, which is people being deeply manifest. And by the way, that comes right through from the Zohar. They're taking these social justice verses about poor and needy constantly. Mm-hmm. That's not an accident. You always have to take the metaphor seriously, I think. And they've done that at times, talking about even the mystical understanding of giving to the poor is kind of uniting the universe, right? So Heschel is pretty closely reading this, I think, in ethos. All right, that's the conclusion for today. Next time we'll pick up with all of this. We'll keep going.
All right. This is very interesting.
Thank you all.
Yeah.
All right. Bye.